Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Okay, so I know you've probably heard the phrase, history repeats itself. Well, it's happening right now. I'm talking about recent history, and it's happening in broad daylight. We're going to talk about that throughout the show tonight with many of the people who would know best. Former Trump aide Sarah Matthews was at the White House on January 6, 2021. She saw political violence in the lead up to it up close. She saw how Donald Trump incited it, and we're seeing that again. And voting rights attorney Mark Elias is very familiar with Republican efforts to delegitimize elections, which, you guessed it, is happening again also. And on that note, I want to start tonight by diving into a story out of Arizona, where last month, a meeting of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors erupted into total chaos. A group of people swarmed the meeting, shouting that the members of the board were illegitimate because of voter fraud. The co-founder of a pro-Trump group even commandeered a podium to announce this is an act of insurrection. One county official even described the events as a coordinated attack. And this stuck with me, a dress rehearsal for the election. So yes, when a bunch of election deniers lost back in 2022, including many of them in Arizona, it may have felt like we were putting this all behind us. But it's important to remember in this moment that we really haven't. Election denier Carrie Lake is running for Senate in Arizona. Mark Finchem, the Oath Keepers member who was at the Capitol on January 6th, is trying to return to the state Senate. And this resurgence of the big lie isn't just happening in Arizona. Right now, the new Trumpy RNC has been taken over by election deniers, too. And they're zeroing in on what they're calling an election integrity strategy. That strategy is, of course, and I'm sure you're tracking this, not about protecting your vote at all. It's about voter suppression and about sowing doubt in the outcome of the election come November. That's what they're focused on. This is all a sign of history repeating itself, but is definitely not the only sign. I was in the White House back in 2016 when Russia was actively intervening in our election on behalf of Donald Trump. I remember it very well, as I'm sure many of you do. And you can ask just about anyone who's been involved in national security, who would know whether the Russians are going to intervene again. And I have. Vladimir Putin has, obviously, your friend, your friend and mine.
Yes, indeed.
He has intervened in our election in the past.
Right.
It's not something, as you experienced firsthand, it's not something we talk about a lot. Do you fear that that is something that could be happening for 2024? And do you think we should be talking about it more?
Well, I think we should be talking about it more. I fear that, you know, the Russians have proved themselves to be quite adept at interfering, and if he has a chance, he'll do it again.
Should we expect Russia to interfere on his behalf in 2024 if he's the nominee?
Yes, of course. They will find ways to interfere. I hope our intelligence community is equipped to respond, maybe better than we did in 2016, but they'll come for this election.
Do you think they're going to intervene in our election again? Do you worry about that? Do you worry?
They're already intervening in our election. I mean, that is happening now.
There's more than that, by the way. And you can take their word for it, or you can really look no further than the fact that the star witness in the Republican effort to impeach President Biden may be, you guessed it, a Russian asset. So we have the sowing of doubt in the electoral process and efforts to suppress the vote from the highest level and in important states. We can see that in Arizona and at the RNC. And we have Russian influence in our political process, which is already underway, unquestionably. When it comes to history repeating itself, there's no example as apparent and as concerning as the rise in political violence. And over the weekend, Donald Trump said there will be a, quote, bloodbath for the country if he loses the election in November. And after I discussed that yesterday, I think it's fair to say the right-wing ecosystem got a little unhinged out there. But they asked us to consider the context. So that's what we did. The context is that Trump kicked off that same rally by saluting the people who were convicted for the deadly assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, all to the tune of the national anthem sung by a choir of imprisoned insurrectionists. The first words out of Trump's mouth in that speech were a big thank you to those rioters, who he called patriots. And at this same rally, he said, quote, "If this election isn't won, I'm not sure that you'll ever have another election in this country." And of course, this is much bigger than one unhinged rally. Donald Trump has been professing political violence for years. In 2017, remember that, when white nationalists descended on Charlottesville in a deadly rally, and Trump said there were very fine people on both sides? In 2020, Trump approached his defense secretary, Mark Esper, about shooting people protesting the death of George Floyd, asking, "Can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something." Over the past few months, Trump has warned of bedlam in the country and potential death and destruction if his criminal charges derail his presidential campaign. And of course, in 2021, Trump convinced his supporters that the election was stolen from him. He awarded any of their remaining faith in our institutions, and he told them to walk to the U.S. Capitol and fight like hell. Then he sat in the White House and watched the scenes on television as political violence engulfed the peaceful transfer of power. So, yes, you absolutely have the option of buying the explanation that he was just talking about the auto industry in that speech over the weekend. You can do that. You can think election deniers in Arizona are harmless because they lost in 2022. And you can ignore the fact that the Russians are back at it, very much so, and assume it's all going to be fine. Or you can play a role in shining a light on all of it, because it's all happening again. History is repeating itself, and everyone needs to be paying attention. Joining me now is someone who was in the White House on January 6, 2021, who witnessed the violent ramifications of Donald Trump's words up close, and who decided to resign her position on that day. Former White House Deputy Press Secretary for the Trump Administration, Sarah Matthews, joins me. Thank you for coming back. I know we've talked before. I've been really looking forward to talking with you. Let me start with the comments from this weekend. What did you hear? I mean, you worked for Trump for some time. You obviously resigned, as I noted, on after January 6th. But he said it's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That will be the least of it. What did you hear when you heard that?
Trump oftentimes speaks in these kinds of incoherent, vague sentences. And so that allows people to draw to the conclusion that they want to fit their own narrative. But I think when you look at this sentence, obviously the Trump campaign is out there saying, of course he's talking about the auto industry. But then why would he use a phrase like, "That's going to be the least of it," immediately afterward? That alludes to something more. And in my eyes, yeah, sure, he could have been talking about the economy. But I think when you're looking at who the messenger was of this message, this is a man who helped incite a deadly insurrection on our nation's capital. So when he's using terms like bloodbath, it's really hard for me to give him the benefit of the doubt.
And he also had a number of phrases I just outlined in that same speech that would be concerning to anyone listening, including applauding insurrectionists and having the national anthem sung by many January 6th rioters. I would also note that he was for the auto industry going bankrupt. So that's important for everyone to remember. You know, I wanted to ask you, one of the things that struck me is that many of the people, the same people who have been working overtime to kind of explain and put into context his comments, have not really seemed to take an issue with the fact that he has been calling insurrectionists hostages, saying immigrants are not people. He saluted people, which is normally reserved for people in the military, as you know, convicted for their role in the insurrection. What do you make of that context here, the kind of overspinning an explanation of one comment when everything else seems okay?
Yeah, exactly. This one comment they're saying is overblown, but it does follow a proven track record of these kinds of unhinged comments from him and an increasingly violent rhetoric and apocalyptic rhetoric almost. When he says things like there's going to be death and destruction if he's charged in these criminal cases, that is, I think, a warning call to his supporters. He's telling them kind of marching orders almost. And we saw this happen in the lead up from the election in 2020 to January 6th. Where he told them to come to the Capitol. He said it was going to be a wild day, that we needed to save our country. So he's putting these kinds of messages out there, hoping that they'll act on them.
As you've said, you're so familiar with his pattern of speech and his language and how he kind of injects things that don't always make sense. And you saw that leading up to January 6th. Do you watch this? I mean, it must be difficult to watch for you personally.
I think it is difficult to watch. It's disheartening because obviously I went and served in the Trump administration because I believed in the policies. I didn't always necessarily agree with everything he said or did, but it's really hard for me now to look at people that I admired, politicians and former colleagues of mine who still are working for him, who are still supportive of him, because I think that he's just gotten increasingly erratic and unhinged in his behavior since losing the election. And I couldn't imagine going to support him or even cast a vote for him, given everything that's transpired, especially when we look at something like January 6th and the stolen election claims. He's never shown any remorse for what happened that day and instead treats it almost like a celebratory occasion. I mean, he, as you noted, plays an alternate national anthem at his rallies. And at the beginning of the rallies, they ask the attendees to please rise for the unfairly treated January 6th hostages, as he calls them. And that's just completely absurd. And so it is really disappointing to think that I once supported this man and believed in his agenda and to see the type of things that he's pushing now.
And the reason I talked about Maricopa County and the events of last month is because you can see people watching and hearing his language and echoing it in the way that we saw leading up to January 6th, which is what's so alarming. I want to ask you about former Vice President Pence, because you know, he said that Donald Trump calling January 6th insurrectionists hostages is unacceptable. Everyone has not said that, certainly. He also said he wouldn't be endorsing Donald Trump. I wanted to get your reaction to those comments and sort of what you think the impact might be or might not be, I guess.
I mean, I honestly got emotional when I heard these comments. I think I know Mike Pence to be someone who is a man of faith, a good man who only wants what's best for this country. And I think that it took a lot of courage for him to come out and say that he would not be endorsing Donald Trump. I mean, look, it's unprecedented. Mm. No vice president has ever said that their own former boss is not fit to serve. And he knew, like I knew when I spoke out against Trump, that that kind of effectively ends your career in Republican politics. And I think he knew that by saying he wasn't going to endorse him, that he might have been kind of signing away any future that he wanted in Republican politics. And so I admire him for coming out and saying that. I wish more Republicans would have a backbone like him and follow suit, because I know that so many Republicans privately say these things and believe Donald Trump is a disaster and unfit to serve and that January 6th is a horrific day for our country, but they would never publicly say these things.
Do you think he's going to stick with it?
Do I think? I hope that Mike Pence sticks with it. Obviously, I think he has said that he won't endorse him right now, but I think that it would be weird for him to go back on his word then and say he's not going to endorse him and then flip. So I think that it would make the most sense for him to stick to it. He did the right thing on January 6th, and I hope that he'll continue to do the right thing and not endorse him. And I don't think that I necessarily expect him to say he's going to vote for Joe Biden, per se, but I don't think
Joe Biden's expecting that either.
Exactly. But I do think that it is a huge statement for a own vice president to say that he is not going to support his former boss. And so I hope that he does stick to his word on that.
Sarah Matthews, I really appreciate you joining me again. I hope you'll join me again in the coming months as we're all trying to make sense of Donald Trump and the election and what people should understand about it. Really appreciate you taking the time. Donald Trump is having an awful lot of trouble securing a bond in his New York fraud case. So what happens next? And when does New York Attorney General Letitia James get to start seizing some assets? New York Times reporter David Farenthold has spent years reporting on his finances, and he joins me in just 60 seconds. So stay where you are.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And it's your last chance to get more fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this limited-time bundle ends June 30th. Save now at cedarpoint.com. Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's Mix and Match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
to take you back to 2016, when Donald Trump said repeatedly that he could self-fund his campaign. Do you remember this? And therefore wouldn't be beholden to donors.
Hillary Clinton's campaign is funded by Wall Street and hedge fund managers. My campaign is powered by my money. I'm self-funding. So I'm not controlled by all these people that control Cruz, that control Hillary, crooked, crooked, crooked Hillary. I have tens and tens of millions of dollars. Nobody else does. I put my own money into this.
Well, guess what? It wasn't true back then. It certainly isn't true today. In a new court filing appealing his civil fraud judgment in New York, Trump's lawyers said today obtaining a bond for $464 million is a practical impossibility. They also said they approached 30, that's basically all of them, different companies that provide appeal bonds, but were rejected by every single one. Sure seems like none of them wanted to take on the $500 million liability. I wonder why. The question is, what happens next? Well, after the judgment was first handed down, New York Attorney General Letitia James did not mince words. She was very clear about what would happen if Trump didn't pay up.
If he does not have funds to pay off the judgment, then we will seek, judgment enforcement mechanisms in court, and we will ask the judge to seize his assets.
I'm sure I'm not the only one wondering which assets Letitia James has her eyes on. Maybe we'll see soon. We'll see. Joining me now is New York Times reporter David Barenthold, who has written extensively about Donald Trump, his court settlements, and his finances. He's going to help us make sense of all of this. So, David, thank you so much. Let me start here. Trump said in his deposition that he had substantially in excess of $400 million in cash. If that's true, none of us are mathematicians, but why isn't he able to come up with the other $170 million here?
Well, probably a couple of reasons. One is that he's already had to put up a lot of cash for the E. Jean Carroll verdict. Remember, there's another verdict out there where he had to pay more than $90 million. So he got a company to put up a bond there by giving them, $91 million of assets as collateral. So that's less. From our calculations, he only has about $350 million in cash, which is a lot, but less than he needs now. So now he's in the situation of, because the E. Jean Carroll money is gone, he's having to ask these bond companies to take a combination of liquid assets and real estate, which apparently they've been unwilling to do, and apparently is just not the practice. They want the cash because they think you're going to lose this case.
So let me ask you about that, because he did reach out to 30 companies, approached them about underwriting the bond, as you said. They all rejected it. What does that tell you? Is that surprising to you? Is that they don't want the risk? Or why did that happen?
Well, remember what we're doing here. The reason that he's reaching out to these people is that he's lost the case, and he's now appealing it. But, appeals like this don't have a huge amount of success. So, the banks don't really want to take a risk here. They don't want to have to take a risk that you're going to fail to do, you're going to lose the case, and they're going to be on the hook for some of the money. They want you to prove that you have the money to pay this right now. That's just how it works in cases like this. And so when this is an unusually large judgment, but the procedure is the same. They want to make sure that he has liquid assets big enough to cover this judgment, which gets bigger every day with interest, and they don't think he does.
So he doesn't have the liquid assets to pay for this, or these financial institutions are evaluating that. He does have a lot of money and properties. I mean, he could just put up a $500 million in properties as collateral, right, to one of these bond companies. Could he do that?
They apparently are saying they won't take real estate as collateral. So he would have to sell the property, get the cash, and then they would take that as collateral.
Okay, so now A.G. James, I'm not suggesting you have any insider information here, but you are familiar with his assets. She has to make good. I mean, she's got to look at the properties. She's threatening to seize assets if it gets to that point, which obviously the judge has to rule. Which buildings do you think are in her eyesight here?
Well, it looks like she would start with the easiest to get stuff. Remember, after this case, she has a pretty good catalog of where all his assets are. So I think she would start with the liquid assets. She would start by seizing bank accounts, brokerage accounts, things where there's liquid assets in there. If she has to seize properties, that's complicated both logistically and also because Trump's properties often have these sort of indentures on them. So, there's a case where Trump Tower, he only really owns the bottom part of Trump Tower and the commercial floors. His golf courses they owe huge amounts of deposits to their golfers, to their members. So you can't just take it and pick it up and take it away. One of the easiest ones to get would be Trump's interest in a building at 1290 Avenue of the Americas in New York. He's a passive investor. He owns a chunk of this building that someone else runs. That would be the easiest on paper to get. But I'm sure every one of these is going to be a fight. Whatever path she chooses, Trump's going to try to fight her.
Now, he owes almost $112,000 every day in interest. That's so much money. Every time I say that or read that, every time it goes, the fine goes unpaid. That it seems like the incentive would be to just pay it or figure it out. But is there incentive for him to delaying it? Because delay seems to be part of his strategy here, too.
Yeah, this is a case where the delay seems to have run out. You know, on Monday, he will owe this money. And if he can't get a bond, then the AG could start seizing these assets. He does have options. He could sell a property. We talked about the limits on his, you know, the kinds of things he could sell, but he could sell a property. He could try to borrow money from a wealthy supporter or foreign government or God knows who, and imagine how much he would owe that person literally and figuratively. Or he could try to declare bankruptcy. That would shut this process down, but would cause a lot of complications for him down the road. It might not work, and it also would be a bad look in the middle of a presidential campaign.
I mean, borrowing money from a company or who knows who might also be a bad look and something we'll all be watching closely. So let me ask you this. I mean, obviously his New York business background is part of his identity. He no longer lives in New York, but some people have shorthanded this as like his New York business is over as we know it. What does it actually look like after this?
Well, I mean, put aside the question of, you know, whether AG James seizes assets or not. Remember, he's been barred by this ruling from running a business in New York for several years. The Trump Organization already was sort of in a weird stasis. It hasn't shrunk that much, but it hasn't grown since he left the office, as it left the White House. So, you know, I don't really know what its reason to be is. It's got a few golf courses. It's got a few hotels. It's got a couple of, you know, it's got Mar-a-Lago. You know, it seems like the smart thing to do already would have been to just get rid of these assets and shrink it down to the places he goes. They've been unwilling to do that so far. This might trigger that kind of collapse or major reorganization.
Fewer places to visit, I suppose, with your name on them, potentially. David Farenthold, thank you so much for explaining, for breaking this all down for us. I really appreciate your time this evening. And coming up next, do you remember this guy? Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. You know the convicted felon? Turns out he's in talks to help out the Trump campaign again this year. I've got some thoughts about that and a refresher you never thought you'd needed when we come right back. Just when you thought this year couldn't get any weirder, The Washington Post reports that Donald Trump is expected to bring back his former 2016 campaign chairman, Paul Manafort. Yes, that guy. And rehire him as an advisor in his current campaign to retake the White House in 2024. So you may be wondering, how is that possible? Paul Manafort is, of course, a convicted felon who was at the center of the Mueller investigation to Russia's interference in the 2016 election. Among other things, he pleaded guilty to witness tampering and conspiring against the United States. He then backed out of his cooperation deal, lied to prosecutors, and went to prison for Trump. And he was serving a 7-year sentence while facing even more charges when Donald Trump pardoned him just before leaving office. Now, despite all of that, Trump is reportedly determined to bring Manafort back into the fold. So determined, in fact, that he could give Manafort a role in the Republican convention this July. Now, that's a pretty big deal. And if a convicted criminal is going to be in charge of the Republican convention this summer, we better brush up not just on his rap sheet, but who exactly Paul Manafort is. So here's the refresher you never knew you'd actually need. I didn't think you'd need it either. First of all, Paul Manafort has been in Republican politics for a while, long time. And no surprise here, he once had a lobbying and consulting firm with another Trump-pardoned convict, Roger Stone. But it was Manafort's deep ties to foreign clients, including a Russian oligarch and the pro-Russian former government of Ukraine, that raised eyebrows after the Kremlin's attack on the 2016 election. I wonder why. Investigators from the Mueller probe and the Senate Intel Committee both found that Manafort regularly exchanged information with a Russian intelligence operative. That Russian operative was this guy, Konstantin Kilimnik. And he's currently wanted by the FBI for his ongoing efforts to interfere in American politics. In dealing with Kilimnik in 2016, Manafort handed over Trump's internal polling data, shared the campaign's plan to win the election, and even discussed specific battleground states. Of course, as the U.S. Treasury Department later confirmed, Kilimnik faithfully relayed all that information to his bosses in the Russian intelligence services. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, an investigation by the Senate Intelligence Committee later revealed that the two pieces of information which are redacted from their report raise the possibility of Manafort's potential connection to the Kremlin's hack and leak operations. Now, we all know that Manafort was swept up in the Mueller probe, but Konstantin Kilimnik, Manafort's associate, who still works for Russian intelligence, continued to wage a covert influence campaign against the United States. According to the DNI, he was part of a Kremlin effort to launder false narratives ahead of the 2020 election. Their goal at the time was to damage U.S. ties to Ukraine, denigrate Biden, and benefits Trump's prospects for re-election. So, given Manafort's dealings with a Russian spy with a track record of election interference, and given that he's been a conduit for Russian influence, it's no wonder he was deemed a grave counterintelligence threat. And that, by the way, is not Bob Mueller saying that. That's from a bipartisan report by senators of both parties. Yet here we are. This is the guy Trump reportedly wants back in his campaign, and to help run the Republican convention, no less. We'll soon see if Republicans are okay with that. Coming up, the big lie is alive and well with the full backing of the RNC. Voting rights attorney Mark Elias is standing by, and he joins me after a short break.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
In 2020, Donald Trump tried and failed to overturn the election through conspiracies and intimidation, but those lies haven't disappeared, as we've been talking about on the show. Instead, they've continued to fester and inspire violence and intimidation against public officials and election workers, including, as we mentioned earlier, in Maricopa County, Arizona. Last month, the Board of Supervisors, a majority of whom are Republican, as you can see what's happening there, were forced to abruptly end a public meeting and be escorted out by police after members of a pro-Trump conspiracy group rushed the dais, shouting that the board was illegitimate. A top county official told the Washington Post that the incident was, quote, an organized, coordinated attack, and that it was a dress rehearsal for the election, which is a pretty chilling statement. Since then, the board has rehearsed emergency evacuation drills, and they've had to. It's terrifying, but it shouldn't really be surprising. Donald Trump continues to push conspiracies about the 2020 election every chance he gets. And the RNC just elected a new chairman with his own history of election denial, who in turn hired a conspiracy theorist as the RNC's senior counsel for election integrity. It's all a pretty clear signal of what to expect ahead of the 2024 election: an organized effort to legitimize election conspiracies and lies in a brazen attempt to undermine Americans' faith in their democracy. We've seen this movie before. Joining me now is Mark Elias. He's a voting rights attorney and the founder of Democracy Docket. You are a very busy man, and I'm so grateful to have you on the show this evening. So let me start here. I mean, the RNC has already filed dozens of what they call election integrity lawsuits, including one just today targeting voter rolls in Nevada. They did one last week in Michigan. The apparatus under Trump's hand-picked leadership appears to be really prioritizing these lawsuits that limit ballot access and support these conspiracies. It seems very, very blatant to me. I mean, they're all in charge of the RNC. Do you see this as different, more alarming, or how would you categorize it than what we saw in the lead-up to 2020?
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, in 2020, we largely caught them flat-footed. And Donald Trump, I think, surprised his own team by coming out against vote by mail and then had the Keystone Cops operation run by the likes of Rudy Giuliani, Jenna Ellis, and Sidney Powell. The bad news is that since January 6, 2021, rather than recoiling from the big lie, The Republican Party has refined it into not only a messaging campaign, not just an electoral campaign, but a litigation strategy. So here are a couple of numbers that should chill everyone. The fact is, in 2021, the year after Donald Trump tried to overturn the election through an insurrection, 25% of all the anti-voting litigation that was filed was brought by the Republican Party and other Republicans. In 2022, that number jumped to 52%. Last year, it was 68%. 68% of all of the bad litigation going on in this country was being sponsored by the Republican Party or its candidates. And already, as you point out, this year, we have seen a flood of new efforts. Rona McDaniel was fired because not because of she couldn't raise money, not because she wasn't Trumpy enough, but because Donald Trump wanted someone who was able to be more effective at making it harder to vote and easier to cheat. And that's what they're going to try to do in 2024.
It seems to be the primary focus of the RNC, and it's important for people to remember, usually party committees are organizing voter outreach and funding state parties and trying to reach out to people. So you've talked about all these lawsuits, which, of course, your focus. I mean, you know, Nevada, Michigan, we mentioned. Are there other tactics that are more under the radar or that aren't getting as much attention that you think people should be aware of?
Absolutely. Look, I have said that we're not going to solve the problems of democracy through the courts. The courts play an important role of backstopping democracy. But fundamentally, what we have right now is a political party that knows it cannot win a majority of the popular vote. In fact, it won't even try. But it can't win if everyone is able to vote who is eligible. So the biggest threat to democracy and free and fair elections this fall is what I have called election vigilantism by conservatives and Republicans. What do I mean by that? Well, we saw it in the run-up of 2022, where you saw people, where you saw conservatives with flak jackets and body armor, with video cameras, staking out drop boxes in Maricopa County, trying to intimidate people simply to return their ballots. We saw unprecedented levels of voter challenges. This is right-wing efforts to misuse voter data to try to prevent lawful people from being able to be registered and vote. We saw 364,000 Georgians challenged in the 2021 election and another 100,000 challenged last year. We have seen these kinds of widespread efforts to try to intimidate election officials and intimidate voters and to try to dissuade them from voting, because that is the Republican playbook, and it is upon all of our responsibilities to fight back against that this fall.
So part of this is obviously preparing, it seems, though you tell me, to challenge or question the outcome of the election in November, especially if Joe Biden wins. What is that going to look like? What should people be prepared to see?
Look, I mean, anyone who thinks that Donald Trump was talking about the auto industry has been living in a cave for the last few years. Donald Trump showed us what he would do in 2020. He would lie. He would spread misinformation. He would coddle up with every bad dictator in the world. Okay. Then when that wasn't enough, he would abuse the legal system. And when that wasn't enough, he would inspire a violent insurrection in the nation's capital to prevent the certification of the election. That's what he was willing to do in 2020. Well, Jen, now he faces a long prison sentence. Right. He faces an existential crisis to himself and his freedom. He will do anything in 2024. And so we should expect to see the tactics that he and the RNC and others will engage in around election intimidation, voter harassment, trying to, intimidate election officials, replace good election officials with big lie adherents. And ultimately, if that is not enough in the aftermath of the election, we have to be ready for him to, as he promised from the stage just the other night, have there be widespread violence.
I mean, Mark Elias, there's so much litigation we got to be watching. I hope we can have you back on many times before the election. Thank you so much for joining me this evening. And coming up, as we head toward the general election, new warning signs about how independent voters see Donald Trump's legal troubles, but some warning signs for the Biden team as well. Amy Walter from the Cook Political Report is standing by here in Washington to explain, and she joins me next. One of the most striking things about the Republican primary was how much Donald Trump's legal troubles seemed to help him. But as we head toward the general election, it's important to remember that independents and the larger electorate are kind of a whole different ball game. Donald Trump will soon be the first president to stand trial on criminal charges, coming up in the middle of April. And a new poll shows that more than a third of independent voters say a guilty verdict in the hush money trial would make them less likely to vote for him. And 75% of independents say the president shouldn't be immune from criminal prosecution. So could his legal troubles finally catch up to him, at least among independents? And in a close election, just how big a difference could that make? Joining me now, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Cook Political Report, Amy Walter. Well, first, let me say that the fact that you're making all the archives available makes, like, a political nerd like me thrilled.
You, any nerd, even if you're not a big nerd, to go back 40 years and look at some of these contests that we're talking about some of these same people today.
Yes.
But in many cases, you can see just the way in which our politics has changed so dramatically.
Yes.
Over the last 40 years in, like, actual print.
And the parties.
So yes, and the parties.
Let me ask you about kind of the poll I just outlined. I mean, polling is tricky.
It's, as we know, a
bet on things. It kind of does surprise me, maybe I shouldn't be surprised, that if he's convicted, it makes such a difference. I mean, people know the facts and details of these. But what do you make of that and sort of the impact of Trump's legal troubles on, say, independents?
I just think it's really hard. Like you said, it's a hypothetical right now. And Mark Blumenthal, who's a Democratic pollster for years and then ran an independent polling group, wrote something the other day that I thought was really smart. You know, back in the time of the impeachment of Bill Clinton in 1998, voters were asked a hypothetical during that, mm-hmm. Saying, if he's impeached, should he resign? Mm. And you had a lot of voters saying, absolutely, he should resign. If the president is impeached, he can't serve any mm-hmm. longer. It made a lot of sense. Until we went through the whole impeachment process, we obviously know what happened in that election. And by the time the impeachment process ended, those same voters were saying, well, no, he shouldn't resign. So I don't know that you can get voters at this moment to say how they will react to whatever is going to come up. And remember, it's not just Trump's legal troubles. Remember, we're going to have the Supreme Court make a lot of decisions mm-hmm. about a lot of other issues. The Alabama Supreme Court now mm-hmm. is a major issue in this election and their decision on IVF.
Yeah, the court system.
The courts are playing a big part. Yeah.
So I want to ask you, you wrote this recent piece. I read it a couple times because it's so interesting. It had a lot of data in it. You love data. I love data. Titled, Biden Hasn't Converted Anti-Trump Voters to Pro-Biden Voters. And the piece is basically about how the Biden team has not converted these people to become, like, they're excited about Joe Biden. A lot of them are still anti-Trump. And you said, if Trump is not at the center of the conversation, Biden's base isn't all that interested in listening to it. And it is one big reason why efforts to sell Biden accomplishments on the economy, jobs, and infrastructure haven't broken through. To succeed, Biden needs this election to be all about Trump. He's got a lot of accomplishments. There are lots of things he can talk about. He can sell them. But it's all about winning. So are you basically saying...
I mean, you know, every campaign, you can't just be about the other person. You have to sell yourself as well. But when you look at the coalition that is the Biden coalition, it's really an anti-Trump coalition. And the numbers that I stated, I thought were really interesting. NBC polling from the going into the 2016 campaign and into that election. Remember, most people who voted for Donald Trump in 2016 weren't pro-Trump. They were anti-Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. right? So he only had about 39% of voters saying, I'm showing up for him. But by the time we got to 2020, 72% of his voters were voting for him, and very few were voting against Biden. Biden came into 2020 about a third saying, I'm voting for Biden, the rest, I'm voting against Trump. That's the same number he's getting in the NBC poll now. That just a third voting for him, essentially, and about two-thirds saying, I'm voting for him because I don't like Trump. So if that's your coalition is motivated by one thing, or mostly one thing, and that is Donald Trump. And the less that Donald Trump's in the picture, mm-hmm. the harder it is for Biden to make his case. You see, any time that Trump comes into the news or something around a Trump issue is front and center, you get much more interest and engagement from the voters who turned out and voted for Biden in the last election.
And there's lots of things people are mad about. It's not one thing, right?
It's not one,
like,
yes.
The interesting thing about it. The other thing I read today, again, more data, is that because a lot of people looked at the fact that Trump was overestimated in polls in a lot of the primaries, and he didn't perform as well in most of them. I mean, 10, 15 points in a number of them. There's a political piece today about how that's not a predictor of the general. And we're for real talk here. There's lots of things to be debated. But I wanted to ask you about that, what you thought, and is that true? Do you agree with that assessment?
No, I absolutely do. The number I always look at with Donald Trump is not the gap between what the vote he's getting and what vote, say, Biden or any of his other opponents are getting. That's what you said about, you know, 18 points, 20 points. Look at the vote share. What percent of the vote is he getting in the polls, and what percent of the vote does he end up getting on Election Day? And they really weren't that far off. It basically tells you what's his floor, or, you know, actually more, what's his ceiling. Mm. And so I think what we learned from the primaries, and we'll be digging more into this, I know the Washington Post also looked into some of these voters who showed up in Georgia and voted for Nikki Haley. Many of them had voted in the Democratic primary in 2020. So it's not to say that there aren't Nikki Haley voters that may be Trump voters from 2020, but there aren't as many as it looks based on those primary results.
When you want to win elections, you got to be clear about the data. Right. Amy Walter, thank you so much. I can't wait to go through every house race with you. That's my dream. It's going to happen one day. I've got one more thing to tell you about before I hand things over to Rachel Maddow. It involves Donald Trump and asbestos. I promise you, we're back after a quick break. Okay, so here's the good news. I promise you we have good news. President Biden's EPA announced today that it is banning the ongoing use of asbestos, which is known to cause lung cancer, mesothelioma, and a long list of other health issues. It also kills tens of thousands of Americans every single year. So lots of people, banning it makes all the sense in the world. But Donald Trump is not most people. The former president actually has a long and loving relationship with asbestos. In a book he wrote in 1997, he falsely claimed that it's 100% safe. He also said the movement against asbestos was led by the mob, because it was often mob-related companies that would do the asbestos removal. And then in 2005, he talked about asbestos during a hearing in the U.S. Senate. My friend Chris Hayes dug up this clip a few years ago, and you kind of have to see it to believe it.
In New York City, we have a lot of asbestos buildings, and there's a whole debate about asbestos. I mean, a lot of people could say that if the World Trade Center had asbestos, it wouldn't have burned down, it wouldn't have melted, okay? A lot of people think asbestos, a lot of people in my industry think asbestos is the greatest fireproofing material ever made. And I can tell you that I've seen tests of asbestos versus the new material that's being used, and it's not even it's like a heavyweight champion against a lightweight from high school. But in your great wisdom, you folks have said asbestos is a horrible material, so it has to be removed.
Just absolute crazy town there. And he was still making that claim on Twitter as recently as 2012. So fast forward to his time as president, and predictably, the Trump administration fought legislation that would have banned asbestos and imposed a policy that the EPA's own scientists warned about. Trump was so well known as the king of asbestos that in 2018, a Russian asbestos company was marketing its product with Trump's face on it. Can't make it up sometimes. Now, Trump's affinity for asbestos almost certainly has to do with the cost of removing it and how much that probably bothered him during his time in real estate. But this is also an important reminder that if he gets back into office, he would likely try to roll back even some of the most sensible government regulations. I think the lesson of the night is that we got to keep our eye on the big stuff, all of the big stuff, including asbestos and the little stuff, including Trump's crazy comments, and basically everything in between. And we'll keep doing that on the show for all of you every time we have it, I promise you. That does it for me tonight. You can catch the show every Sunday at 12 p.m. and Monday at 8 p.m. on MSNBC. And don't forget to follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For now, goodbye from Washington, and we'll see you next week.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium-iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.